ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. American car companies got a break in the trade war. President Trump says he'll give them 1 month before increasing taxes on the auto trade between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, Iowa removed transgender and non-binary people as a protected group in its civil rights law. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm E. Martinez. We hear from an Iowa parent who says he's scared for his trans teen. Also, what the foreign minister of Lesotho thinks after President Trump told Congress that no one's ever heard of his African country. It's Thursday, March 6th. We remember that on this day in 1836, Mexican soldiers took over the Alamo. Davy Crockett and the others defending it were killed. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Ukraine and its allies have condemned President Trump's decision to suspend all U.S. military aid to Kyiv. Trump has also halted the sharing of U.S. intelligence with Ukraine. But Russia is praising the actions. Ukrainian politicians say the U.S. is helping the Kremlin. This follows a fiery disagreement last week between Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Ukrainian lawmaker Kira Rudik says the developments are painful.
We hope that we'll have some insight from our allies about what could be done to fix the relations. But the question is, what's the end game? Because there is one question that we have not heard an answer to. How do we make sure that Russia would not attack us again? Everybody is asking what Ukraine is ready to cede, but the answer about the security guarantees is simply not there.
She spoke to the BBC. Meanwhile, European leaders are holding an emergency summit today in Brussels. They're also alarmed over the change in U.S. policy toward Ukraine and toward the European continent. President Trump is expected to issue an executive action calling on Education Secretary Linda McMahon to begin dismantling the Department of Education. NPR's Corey Turner reports the order could be issued as early as today.
A draft of the executive action obtained by NPR calls on Secretary McMahon to act to the maximum extent appropriate and permitted by law to begin unwinding the Education Department. NPR reported the action's existence a month ago, but it was held until after McMahon's Senate confirmation. On Monday, after that vote, McMahon said in a message to department staff that helping her close the department was, quote, an opportunity to perform one final unforgettable public service. The department's primary role in K-12 education is enforcing civil rights laws and sending money to help schools educate low-income students and children with disabilities. Corey Turner, NPR News.
Stocks opened lower this morning as investors try to sort out the Trump administration's trade policy. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled about 480 points in early trading.
Stocks briefly rallied in the previous session after President Trump agreed to a limited reprieve on tariffs that took effect a day earlier. But the break is only for autos, and it's only for 1 month. Everything else coming into the U.S. from Mexico or Canada is now subject to steep import taxes, and the White House is threatening to add more tariffs in the coming weeks. The U.S. trade deficit rose to a record high in January as importers raced to bring in products before the tariffs took effect. Imports jumped more than $36 billion during the month, while exports rose only slightly. New claims for unemployment benefits fell last week after a big jump the week before. Widespread layoffs in the federal government have not yet shown up in the data. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down about 420 points. This is NPR. NPR has learned that the Department of Veterans Affairs is planning to slash its workforce by about 80,000 jobs. An internal VA memo is setting the staffing level goal to what it was in 2019. This effort is led by the cost-cutting entity DOGE. The federal agency grew after Congress passed a law expanding health care and benefits to millions of veterans sickened by toxic exposures. Many VA staffers were then hired to assist veterans. California officials are expanding an environmental project to 64 cities. The initiative uses cars that can detect pollution. From member station KALW, Crystal Rahim reports this project launched in Oakland.
The program is a partnership between the West Oakland Environmental Indicators Project and ACLIMA. an air quality monitoring company based in California's Silicon Valley. The initiative differs from previous projects because it uses cars equipped with pollution detecting sensors, which are able to track air quality data throughout neighborhoods. Data collected in West Oakland through a pilot program showed that the proximity to port sites and heavily trafficked areas were found to alter resident air quality significantly. According to project data, diesel particulate matter in West Oakland went down by a third and cancer risks were reduced by more than half. For NPR News, I'm Crystal Rahim in Oakland, California.
A tropical cyclone is starting to lash the east coast of Australia. The effects of Tropical Cyclone Alfred are expected to last into the weekend. It's NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics with I'm Still Here, a film by Walter Salles starring Fernanda Torres. A woman is forced to reinvent herself after her family suffers an injustice by the Brazilian government. Now playing only in theaters.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, how would President Trump's proposals for Social Security affect the benefits that people receive, if at all? First,
as 25% tariffs on goods from Canada and Mexico take hold, President Trump has announced another one-month reprieve.
The president's latest sudden shift is only for car makers. They are a huge source of cross-border business. It is common for parts to cross the border several times as American-made cars are assembled. U.S. automakers warned the tariffs would raise the price of their cars by thousands of dollars.
NPR's Camila Domonoske covers the auto industry. Camila, so where did this pause come from?
Well, it is no secret. The Detroit automakers, so that's Ford, General Motors, Stellantis, they have been lobbying for this for months. Secretary of Commerce Howard Lutnick went on Fox News yesterday, and he said that the big three spoke to the White House.
They made their pitch, and what they said was, look, we're domestic American automakers, and if you put a 25% tariff on us, and you don't put it on the Germans, and you don't put it on the Koreans, and you don't put it on the Japanese, you're helping everybody but us. So come on.
And specifically, what the big three had asked for was that these tariffs not apply to either cars or parts for cars that meet the strict requirements for the USMCA. That's the trade agreement between the US, Canada, and Mexico that Trump negotiated in his first term to replace the previous agreement known as NAFTA. So most cars made in North America meet these requirements, but not all of them. So it's a reprieve for most vehicles made in Canada, Mexico, or the U.S. by any automaker, but it would particularly help the U.S. automakers.
Okay, but Trump says that these tariffs are coming back in April for every car, for all cars. So how much does a 30-day pause even help?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's time for companies to figure out some logistics, maybe stockpile a few parts, but it is not nearly enough time to, for instance, move an auto plant to the U.S. to avoid tariffs. I spoke to Angela Gamalski, a trade lawyer who works with the auto industry.
One of the clients that I've been working with is weighing that exact question. How do we reshore? And their best estimate is looking at 2 years.
2 years. Meanwhile, this is a policy that was in place for only 1 day for these vehicles and has been pushed back twice. And even for the rest of the Mexico and Canada tariffs, which are still in place for all these other goods, there is just so much uncertainty about how long they're going to be in place.
So what does this mean then for the people who sell cars and the people that want to be car buyers?
Yeah, so a 1 day tariff, obviously not much. There's still those smaller number of vehicles that are hit by this tariff. And if they come back and stick to all of them, they will make cars even pricier. And of course, Trump is promising many more tariffs to come. So these particular tariffs on Canada and Mexico, if they stayed in place a while, we would be looking at new cars going up in price, almost certainly by thousands of dollars. Car parts get more expensive, used cars, repairs, insurance get more expensive through ripple effects. The UAW, the Auto Workers Union, did put out a statement this week acknowledging the pain caused by tariffs, but also saying the working class felt the pain of NAFTA, and tariffs are a way to bring jobs to the U.S. by making it more expensive to manufacture overseas. The White House has said that's the ultimate goal. It's also said the goal is to stop fentanyl at the border. One's long-term, one's immediate. It's really confusing, and it's hard for companies to make plans, including plans to move factories.
Camila Domonoske covers cars for NPR. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Next, we'll try to understand what President Trump's proposals mean for Social Security. Here's what he told Congress on Tuesday night.
I'm calling for no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, and no tax on Social Security benefits for our great seniors.
Okay, getting rid of a lot of taxes, and he also said that he would not cut benefits. Senator Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan cast doubt on that when she delivered Tuesday's Democratic response.
He could very well come after your retirement. The Social Security, Medicare, and VA benefits you worked your whole life to earn. The president claims he won't, but Elon Musk just called Social Security the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time.
Elon Musk did say that. So, what do the facts show about these conflicting claims? Mark Goldwine is going to help us here. He's Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, which advocates for the thing that's in the group's name. Mr. Goldwine, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so the president said he wants no taxes on Social Security benefits. Does everybody who gets Social Security at some point gain from that?
No, about half of people that get Social Security at some point pay income taxes on it. And it's mostly people in the upper half. But if you were to cut those taxes, not only does it increase their after-tax benefits, it also reduces money that's actually going into the Social Security and Medicare Trust Fund, because that money actually pays the benefits. And so doing that no tax would mean higher after-tax benefits for the upper half, but ultimately it would mean a more insolvent program for everybody.
Wait a minute. So you said the upper half. So people who make more money pay less taxes, but then there's less money to go around for everyone? Is that what you just told me?
That's exactly right. And it means that instead of being insolvent in 8 years, Social Security might be insolvent in 6 or 7 years. And the size of the benefit cut when we can't afford those dollars would be larger.
Whoa. You just said benefit cut as if this is an assumed thing, but we've been told the president says he's not going to cut benefits. How would benefits come to be cut under this idea?
Yeah, President Trump has not proposed any direct cuts to Social Security old age benefits basically in his entire career. But here's the rules. Social Security can only pay in benefits what it's bringing in revenue plus what's in the trust fund. And right now, it is spending more than it is taking in. And so in only a few years, there will be an automatic benefit cut. Under current law, it would be 21%. Everybody in 8 years gets a 21% cut. But if you start doing things like no taxes on benefits, that cut could be significantly higher, 25% or more.
Are you telling me that that cut would come in several years for everybody that is currently on Social Security?
If Congress doesn't make changes, this is an across-the-board cut for everybody, right? So today's 62-year-olds will be 70, maybe even younger.
I suppose if you're a lawmaker or the president of the United States, there's a couple of ways you can deal with this. One is you can ignore it and figure you'll be out of office by then and it'll be somebody else's problem. But another is you can try different ways to make the math actually work. Are lawmakers discussing different ways to make the math work a little better here?
Look, a lot of lawmakers understand the types of policies that need to be made. Either you bring in more revenue, you know, maybe by raising that payroll tax or the amount of income that's subject to it. You change the benefit formula. you change the retirement age, or you change the cost of living adjustment. They understand the options, but to be honest, most of them want to wait to the last minute, hoping that somebody else will actually have to make those choices instead of them.
Is it possible that we could grow our way out of this problem, just have such spectacular economic growth that we don't have to worry about it in 6 years?
No, it would be impossible. We are so far from out of balance that no amount of growth could get there in time. And the other thing about growth is Social Security benefits actually rise faster when the economy grows faster because they're indexed to wages.
Ah, so the more we're earning, the more we're paying, okay? One other thing to ask about in the time we have left, the administration has zeroed in on what they say is waste, fraud, and abuse. And Speaker Mike Johnson said, intuitively, we just know there's a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse. In the opening weeks, DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, seems to have documented virtually none of that, although Elon Musk made this statement about a Ponzi scheme. Is there any evidence that there's billions and billions and billions of dollars of waste, fraud, and abuse in Social Security?
Yeah, Social Security has a very small fraud rate because it's very easy to know how old people are. Doesn't mean that there's not any, and of course we should cut it out, but it is a very tiny share, less than 1% of the program's cost.
And since you said how old people are, we should just note the thing about people being 150 years old or whatever, that's just a computer entering data issue?
There's maybe hundreds of people collecting benefits that are older than they're supposed to be, not thousands or millions.
Okay, Mark Goldwein, thanks so much.
President Donald Trump is defending his administration's foreign aid cuts. In his Tuesday night address, one country got a special mention. Here's Kate Bartlett.
The national anthem of Lesotho, a small southern African nation, dubbed the kingdom in the sky for its majestic mountains. But according to President Trump, who struggled to pronounce its name, it's an example of wasted U.S. humanitarian aid dollars.
$8 million to promote LGBTQI+ in the African nation of Lesotho, which nobody has ever heard of.
NPR got hold of Lesotho's foreign minister, Lejone Mpotuan, and asked him what he thought of the president's remarks.
We are shocked by the statement that no one knows about Lesotho.
The country has a population of some 2.3 million and is a former British protectorate surrounded entirely by South Africa.
Lesotho and the United States of America have a long bilateral relation since the independence of the Mountain Kingdom of Lesotho in 1966.
While it's not clear exactly what LGBTQ earmarked funds Trump was referring to, impoverished Lesotho has long been a recipient of USAID money. Much of that goes towards HIV treatment and prevention in a country where about a quarter of a million people are living with the disease.
Lesotho, like other countries, has really been affected by the cuts in funding that President Trump's administration has put into place in recent days.
Tlohang Letsia is a politics lecturer at the National University of Lesotho.
The cut of the HIV/AIDS-related funding to Lesotho has been a very, very serious blow.
Letsia said Trump's comments that no one knows where Lesotho is were uncalled for.
He should understand that despite the fact that he is the president of a large country, he has the responsibility to respect his counterparts, no matter how small or poor their countries are.
But despite the slight, Minister Mpotuan invited Trump to visit the capital, Maseru, and see the country for himself.
I'll be happy to receive His Excellency the President here in Maseru. Indeed, we do have a golf course near the American Embassy here in Maseru.
Trump's African-born advisor, Elon Musk, can place the country on a map. He met Lesotho's Prime Minister just months ago to discuss taking his Starlink satellite internet service there. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
This is NPR News. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Simu Liu. He's best known for his breakout role as Shang-Chi, Marvel's first Asian superhero, and for playing a rival Ken in the film Barbie. He now stars with Woody Harrelson in the new film Last Breath, about deep-sea divers who perform a life-saving rescue. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 9.5 inches of ground clearance. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at Metamucil.com. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. As we've been reporting, Iowa removed transgender and non-binary people as a protected group in the state civil rights law. Governor Kim Reynolds signed a bill last week striking the words gender identity from that law. She says the language blurred the lines between the sexes.
What this bill does accomplish is to strengthen protections for women and girls, and I believe that it is the right thing to do.
She said that this provides protections for women in sports and in restrooms. So what's it mean for people who lose that language? Our colleague Layla Follow spoke with Matt McIver, a parent of a transgender teen in Des Moines.
You know, I remember speaking to you 2 years ago when Governor Reynolds banned gender-affirming care for trans minors, and you had met with her to try to persuade her not to sign that bill into law. And now there is this rollback in the civil rights law, meaning your child is no longer protected under it. What do you make of her comment that this is about protecting women and girls?
It's the smallest kind of fig leaf, Layla. It is an excuse to persecute an ongoing attack on a vulnerable community. If they were actually interested in helping women, they would be doing something about Iowa's rising maternal mortality rate. They wouldn't pass a 6-week abortion ban, which puts women's lives in danger. There's any number of ways in which they could actually help women if they were interested in that, but it's not something that they're genuinely interested in doing. It's an excuse.
It feels like persecution?
I think it's more than feels at this point. If our rights are not rights for everyone, they're simply privileges that are granted to in-groups. This is an attack on the fundamental rights of Iowans, and it is an attack that undermines our state's motto, which is our liberties we prize and our rights we will maintain.
If you could just break down for people what it means when a group of people is removed as a protected class from the civil rights law in Iowa. What does that mean for Iowans who are transgender, who were once protected, who are now not?
It means that you can be evicted from your apartment simply for being transgender or being believed to be transgender. It means you can be denied a credit card simply for being transgender or being believed to be transgender. It means you can be fired from a job for being transgender or being believed to be transgender. You do not have the fundamental protections that we expect in a civil society. It's a horrifying thing that they did, and it has nothing to do with sports. If you look at athletes, transgender athletes are something like 0.001% of NCAA athletes. It's a ridiculously small number, and as a result, they are an easier target than many other groups that have better representation.
How's your family doing? How's your son doing?
I appreciate that. We have two LGBTQ kids. It's upsetting and distressing for the kids, for sure. But I'm not as worried about my kids. My wife and I will make sure that our kids are fine. There are lots of kids who aren't going to have the luxury of knowing that.
I mean, I don't know if you want to share this, but how old is your son?
Teenage years.
Teenage years. Okay. If you feel comfortable, was there a conversation after this happened? And what was that conversation?
I'm going to keep this a little bit vague, Layla, just because
sure.
This is a less safe state than it was even when you and I spoke 2 years ago.
So you don't even feel safe being really specific about this conversation because of the laws?
I would say that, yes. I'm comfortable talking to you. I'm a person who checks pretty much every box of privilege that there is. But I know for a fact that this is a less safe place for LGBTQ folks, and I would like to be a little bit protective.
So you're scared for your child?
I am.
And then you said you're going to be a bit vague, but do you want to share anything within that vague sort of comfortable category?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I said that this is awful. I said that it's wrong. I said that we're going to keep fighting. But I told them, pardon the language, but it sucks. I don't know if I can say that, but I used to think that once rights were secured, they were safe. But we've seen that that's not true in this country, that there are people who will try and strip away rights from others to make themselves, I don't know, feel big, feel better. And we have to continue to fight for the rights of everyone. Because once we start stripping away rights from someone, no one is safe.
Matt McIver of Des Moines, Iowa, a parent. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Lila.
Jazz funk pioneer Roy Ayers has died after a long illness. He was 84 years old. Here's NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento.
Roy Ayers started vibing early. Here's a story he liked to tell. When he was 5 years old, his family took him to a concert by the vibraphonist Lionel Hampton. Ayers grooved so hard that Hampton handed him his first pair of mallets. When Ayers himself took up the vibes, it was in LA's hard bop scene in the 1960s. He mixed jazz improvisation with sunlit funk grooves and bright horns. In 1976, he struck gold with the song Everybody Loves the Sunshine. My life, my life, my life, my life in the sunshine. Everybody loves the sunshine. Ayers spoke about his signature hit decades later on a TV interview with UK journalist Sonia Saul.
I was inspired by my upbringing in Los Angeles, California, when there was no smog. And that's what really inspired me to compose that song.
Ayers, in turn, inspired generations. Everybody Loves the Sunshine alone has been sampled more than 100 times. Ayers also collaborated with younger artists like Tyler, the Creator. In a PBS interview, Tyler said he grew up listening to Ayers' music, and he was honored to work with someone he considered a legend.
I sent him the song I wanted him on, and he called me and was just like, oh, young man, oh, Tyler, these changes, they cold, man. These chords are cold.
Roy Ayers kept the vibes going, collaborating and releasing new music until the last decade of his life. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News. My life, my life, my life, my life, and the sunshine.
Everybody loves the sunshine. Sunshine. Everybody loves the sunshine.
Sunshine. This is NPR News.
Mickey Barnes is unexpendable. His job is to explore space, endure violent deaths, and be reprinted to die again.
You're Mickey 16?
17. Jerk.
And the inspiration for the aliens Mickey meets?
Croissant.
Croissants. I'm Ari Shapiro, director Bong Joon-ho on his wild new movie, Mickey 17, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump is giving U.S. automakers a one-month exemption to the 25% tariffs enacted this week on imports from Canada and Mexico. The White House says this follows Trump's discussions with executives at Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis. Farmers in North Dakota say they're worried about what the president's tariffs will do to their economic survival. NPR's Kirk Sigler has more.
At the annual North Dakota Winter Ag Show, tariffs, namely of the retaliatory kind from next door in Canada, are top of mind for vendors like Butler Machinery. Justin Stringer sells farm equipment across the Dakotas and says there's a lot of local anxiety that prices for everything will go up even more.
When you're getting them tariffs put on from a factory, it's, you know, how do we help our customers take less impact? Because we want to keep our customers strong and our economy strong, and we know what the backbone of the country is.
During the last trade war in 2018, the previous Trump administration sent billions in aid to the Midwest, but many farmers here say they still haven't fully recovered, and now a new tariff war is looming. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Jamestown, North Dakota.
The U.S. trade deficit hit a record high in January as companies boosted imports ahead of the president's new tariffs. The trade gap rose by 34% during the month. This is NPR News. The Justice Department is investigating allegations of anti-Semitism at the University of California. As Steve Futterman reports, the accusations stem from campus protests about the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza.
The investigation follows an executive order signed by President Trump designed to combat what the administration calls an explosion of anti-Semitism at colleges since the war in Gaza began. Justice Department attorneys say they believe there is a potential pattern of discrimination on UC campuses against Jewish employees. Last year, during the height of the campus protests, there were encampments at several UC schools, including Berkeley and UCLA. A UC spokesperson says the schools are unwavering in their commitment to combat anti-Semitic actions. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
Utah has become the first state to pass legislation requiring app stores to verify the ages of its users and to obtain parental consent for minors to download apps to their devices. Mortgage rates in the U.S. have declined for a sixth consecutive week. Freddie Mac says the average 30-year fixed-rate loan has fallen to 6.76%. The rate topped 7% in mid-January. On Wall Street, stocks are lower this morning. The Dow is down 230 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Nearly 6,000 fired employees of the U.S. Department of Agriculture should be heading back to work today.
An independent federal board ordered them reinstated for 45 days while its investigation into the firings continues.
NPR's Andrea Hsu has been following all of this. So, Andrea, how do these workers at USDA get their jobs back?
Yeah, well, in short, the system set up to hear federal employee complaints about things that happened to them on the job worked. You know, tens of thousands of probationary employees have been fired since last month. These are people typically in their first or second year on the job. And some of them filed complaints with the Office of Special Counsel. That's the watchdog agency set up to investigate such complaints. And their investigation into the USDA found a pattern. You know, nearly 6,000 people got basically the same letter telling them that they were being fired because of their performance.
All 6,000 people had performance problems?
No, I mean, in fact, many of them had excellent performance reviews. Investigators found the agency didn't even look at their performance, which is a requirement if you're going to fire workers during the probationary period in the federal government. Instead, the special counsel said the firings appeared to be part of an attempt to shrink the government, which administrations can do, but they have to go through a bunch of procedures, including giving people 60 days notice, which the USDA did not do. Now, the Merit Systems Protection Board reviewed the findings so far, and the board chair concluded, yes, these firings probably were unlawful, and she ordered the USDA to bring back their probationary workers for 45 days so the investigation can continue. But then last night, there was yet another twist in this case. The special counsel, Hampton Dellinger, who was leading the investigation, was removed from his position for the second time. President Trump first tried to fire him about a month ago. A U.S. district judge reinstated him, but now an appeals court has removed him once again while it considers the arguments in his case.
So then what happens with the investigation? I mean, what about all the workers at the other agencies who were fired?
Yeah, it's not entirely clear. We know that Dellinger had evidence that what happened at USDA had happened at other agencies. In fact, yesterday he issued a statement urging all agencies to go ahead and reinstate their probationary employees voluntarily and not wait for an order. Now, his removal doesn't change the board's order to USDA to give those nearly 6,000 workers their jobs back. But of course, it's one agency and it's a temporary stay.
Okay, now how are USDA workers reacting to the news that they're reinstated?
Well, they're not exactly celebrating. I spoke with Michelle Kirchner, an entomologist who was helping alfalfa growers manage pests when she was fired last month. And here's what she said.
I'm feeling kind of yanked around a little bit. I mean, it's good. I'm glad that like something is coming out that what happened wasn't correct and was potentially illegal.
But she says it's impossible to have any confidence in what's going to happen in the long term. The Trump administration has made clear it wants to dramatically shrink the federal government. So she thinks maybe they'll all be brought back only to be fired again.
You mentioned the Trump administration. What is the Trump administration saying about all this?
Well, they maintain that they've done nothing illegal. They've made this case in federal court where there's a lawsuit over probationary firings, and there's another hearing next week. And meanwhile, the administration is moving forward with much deeper cuts to federal agencies that will affect career employees, longtime employees, so a lot more uncertainty is ahead.
All right, that's NPR's Andrea Hsu. Andrea, thanks.
You're welcome.
More than 1 million Ukrainians and Ukrainian-Americans live in the United States, enough to make their own major city. Many have watched closely as the U.S. responded to Russia's attacks on Ukraine across more than a decade, and then they watched in recent days as President Trump and Vice President Vance berated Ukraine's president last week and then cut off military aid and intelligence sharing. So what are Ukrainians thinking now? Carmen Russell-Sluchansky of member station WHYY went to see some.
It's the 18th annual futsal tournament at the Ukrainian American Cultural Center of New Jersey. Futsal is an indoor version of soccer. Roman Chupraniak, the coach for the Philadelphia-based team, the Ukrainian Nationals, was born in Ukraine but emigrated to Philadelphia when he was 16 years old. Like many of the Ukrainian American visitors here today, Chupraniak's mind is on the war in the homeland and the radical shift the United States appears to be taking in the conflict. He says he blew up with anger watching President Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance's meeting with Zelensky.
It really just confirmed what I was afraid of. That's why I didn't vote for the guy. This is what I was thinking that will happen. He's just going to do something crazy that's not going to be for Ukraine, that's all. And this is what's happening. He's not getting the deal he wants. He's getting angry. And his vice president is even worse.
Nearly 200,000 people of Ukrainian descent live in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Several thousand, like Irina Grach, were born in Ukraine. She was picking up her 9-year-old twins from their classes at the center. Grach says she's always loved America for standing up for what's right. That changed when she watched the meeting between Trump and Zelensky.
All that was shattered because the strongest person in the United States bullied and beaten someone who has been struggling for the last 3 years without a chance to defend himself in the foreign language and being attacked on the foreign territory.
Grach identifies as a Republican, but says she voted against Trump in November. She says Ukraine wasn't even a factor. She just felt he didn't have integrity. Oksana Telepka teaches at the Cultural Center. Her two grown daughters speak Ukrainian despite growing up in the U.S. She said the community strongly supports Zelensky, and that support has increased since the ill-fated White House visit.
We all care about our native land. Everybody has a different opinion, but people know we have to stay together and support the president. And only when we're going to stay together, then we can do something.
23-year-old Maxim Bukachevsky plays for New Jersey-based Shakhtar United. He voted for Trump in November, but didn't like how the president treated Zelensky.
I don't think I would change my vote, but I was disappointed in how he acted personally, yes, especially being Ukrainian-American.
Bukachevsky is still hopeful that Trump will pursue peace in the region.
I do think, you know, with Donald Trump's relationship with Putin, they can possibly, you know, work out something with Zelensky.
The Ukrainian-American Cultural Center says it has sent $4 million in aid to Ukraine, including food, ambulances, medical supplies, and diapers. For NPR News, I'm Carmen Russell-Sluchansky in Whippany, New Jersey.
Hey, thanks for listening to your public radio station, which brings you Morning Edition each day. Voices from across this country and here in Washington. A full picture of what's going on. Many points of view. Later today on All Things Considered, how did Vice President Vance come to play a role as the administration's foreign policy provocateur? Listen on the radio, in the NPR app, or by asking your smart speaker for your local station by name. This is NPR News.
In Mississippi says she's ashamed that she used drugs during her pregnancy, but now she's sharing her story to help other women. Next time, Here and Now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, me Martinez. Ukraine's Ministry of Justice says some parents are naming their children with a nod to Russia's full-scale invasion. Boy names include Miroliub, one who enjoys peace, and Artur Bayraktar, the name of a Turkish-made drone. Now, for girls, Stefania has been very popular. That's the name of Ukraine's song that won 2022's Eurovision Song Contest. But variations of Javelin, the anti-tank missile, have been used for both boys and girls. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From USPS, USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. For decades, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's all-time scoring record of 38,387 points was deemed unbreakable until LeBron James, who surpassed it 2 years ago. And now LeBron hit a new milestone.
LeBron, open three! Got it! 22 seasons, 40 years of age! LeBron James, 50,002 points!
That's combined playoffs and regular season. Now, with numbers like that, can LeBron James now be called the greatest basketball player of all time, the GOAT? Let's ask Jesse Washington. He's with ESPN's Anscape. So what are some arguments for and against LeBron claiming that title?
Yeah, well, what LeBron has done is really, really unprecedented. The man is 40 years old, 4-0, and I'm not a math guy, but that's 4 times 10. And what he's doing is just amazing at that age. You know, Michael Jordan, who is the other contender for the GOAT crown, when he was 38 and 39 playing with the Wizards, he did not look like this. So just the counting stats, what LeBron is doing at his age is pretty amazing.
Yeah. What tends, though, to be the thing that would divide someone, either picking one or the other? Because it seems to me when I've had these arguments when I used to be a sports radio host, Jesse, is that championships. Jordan went to 6 NBA finals and never lost. LeBron has been to 10 finals and lost 6 of them.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, it's them rings. The rings and things, bring them out, bring them out. And so Michael is perfect in that. Michael's got 6 finals MVPs. You know, he's the ultimate winner. He made an everlasting joke of Byron Russell when he sat him down for the series winner against the Utah Jazz. So those kind of moments. And also the thing that really separates Michael is people who saw him play. I mean, it's really hard to describe. He was like an alien from another planet. And I'm not talking about Wemby, like a relatively normal-sized human being doing things that no physical person should be able to do, flying. I mean, he flew. Let's not get it twisted. And so just the eye test with Michael, his competitiveness, sort of his legend grows over time, all the stories you hear about him just turning it on at will and utterly annihilating other folks. You know, those legends grow perhaps to unrealistic dimensions as the years pass, but the rings and the legend and just the mythos of Michael Jordan is what really puts him at the top of a lot of people's lists.
The thing is, though, Jesse, I think you probably know this too, but any GOAT debate is 100% subjective. So why do you think this resonates so much with sports fans?
Yeah, because it's fun. Because we get to crack on the young guys. Because we get to tell them they don't know what we're talking about. I'm official OG, you know. And so we get to, back in my day, we played with one hand behind our back in the winter and still scored 30. You know, so it's just fun, man. I mean, what else do we got to do while we're waiting 2 hours for a barbershop cut on a Saturday? That's what we do.
And that generational divide too, you mentioned people that have seen Michael Jordan play. I grew up in LA in the 80s, so no one's going to tell me that Magic isn't the great. I mean, that's my greatest of all time. So I think it's one of those things where you're kind of in the moment and you make that emotional decision.
Yeah, Magic and LeBron are pretty close. You know, LeBron is 4th all time in assists. He's the only, you know, non-point guard anywhere in the top 20. So that's pretty amazing. And also, you know, let's not short LeBron for what he's done and continues to do. Anybody who saw that windmill left-handed dunk that he had earlier is like, what are we really looking at? We're looking at something we've never, ever seen before.
Defying time. That's Jesse Washington, senior writer with ESPN's Anscape. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Costco leaned into DEI. What's that meant for the bottom line?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. Later today, after the stock market closes, Costco, that's the warehouse membership club, will release its latest quarterly earnings. While some retailers and grocery chains have backed away from commitments related to diversity, equity, and inclusion, Costco has very publicly dug in. Some consumers and groups have promised to spend more at the big box store because of it. But will that actually affect the bottom line? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
When it comes to shifts in consumer spending, particularly at specific retailers, it can be hard to parse exactly what's behind it. Katie Thomas leads the Kearney Consumer Institute.
I think we'll see that some consumers have shifted more purchases to Costco because they are in favor of the DEI announcements.
But at the same time, and for the same reason, some consumers have shifted their shopping dollars away from Costco. So says Ivan Feinseth, director of research at Tigris Financial Partners.
I don't think you'll see an effect. I think guidance may be more impacted by the potential tariffs.
But over time, says Deirdre Popovich, who teaches marketing at Texas Tech University.
I do think that we will be able to see indicators for corporate success in the next few months.
And that will tell us just how consumers are voting with their wallets when it comes to companies and their DEI commitments. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
In a major geopolitical shift, Europe is going to be spending a lot more on defense. European leaders are meeting in Brussels today for emergency talks on spending and the war in Ukraine. That's after the Trump administration announced this week the U.S. will pause military aid to Ukraine. Marketplace's Henry Epp reports.
Germany could soon ramp up its military spending after the country's likely next chancellor announced a plan this week that would exempt defense from Germany's strict fiscal policies. The incoming government also proposed the equivalent of a $540 billion package aimed at boosting the country's transportation, energy, and digital infrastructure. It would be a significant break from tradition for Germany, which has historically kept tight limits on government debt. That news pushed European stock markets higher this week. Bond yields in Germany rose on the expectation that more spending means the government will issue more debt, sending bond prices lower. Meanwhile, the European Union has made moves to allow other countries in the bloc to increase military budgets as well without incurring penalties. Along with a planned loan package from the EU, the moves could push more than $800 billion into defense over the next 4 years, according to Bloomberg. All this comes as the Trump administration has walked back from military support of Ukraine. That aid had bipartisan support under the Biden administration, and it's been key to Ukraine's efforts to push back on Russia's invasion of the country, which began just over 3 years ago. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is down 153 points. That is 0.4%. The S&P 500 is down 0.8%. The NASDAQ is down 0.5%. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.33%. And after President Trump imposed 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico, now Canadian provinces are jumping into the fight. They've started to take U.S. liquor off their shelves. Brown-Forman stock, that's the folks who make Jack Daniels, down 3.6%. Meanwhile, the Toy Association, that's the group representing the toy industry in the U.S., says tariffs are going to increase toy prices by about 15% to 20% by back-to-school shopping time.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by The Economist, devoted to providing independent journalism that makes sense of the news shaping the world. More at economist.com or with The Economist app, newsletters, and podcasts.
Tomorrow morning, the Labor Department releases the February jobs report. This is a tally of all the jobs lost and gained across the country in February. It is the first jobs report to fall fully under the new Trump administration. And so much has happened since then. Mass federal government layoffs, downsizing by DOGE, there's the new tariffs, there were the big drops in consumer confidence and in the stock market. How much all of that will actually show up in tomorrow's report? That is an open question. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
January was a weird month. Bad winter weather and fires in California kept job creation low while the unemployment rate actually fell. February could also be weird, or at least packed with surprises, but not for the reasons one might think, says Dan North at credit insurer Allianz Trade North America.
It's not so much the DOGE firings or laying offs. That's going to show up in the next couple of months.
Those happened too late to be captured in February's jobs report. Rather, says North, with tariffs and inflation and market volatility,
uncertainty has reached a magnificent scale under this administration. If corporations feel that much uncertainty, I think that's going to cool the hiring process.
Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research agrees.
The two strongest sectors for job growth have been healthcare and state and local governments. Think of someone operating a hospital or a city counting on government grants. They're going to be very cautious. So I expect a lot of hiring won't show up in February.
We already know one weak spot last month, small business employment, according to data from Intuit, crunched by University of Chicago economist Ufuk Agcicic.
Businesses that employ at most 9 workers, down by 0.99%, which is a substantial decline.
Agcicic says they're suffering from inflation, high interest rates, and, again, uncertainty.
Businesses are forward-looking. They would be more risk-averse in new hires. But at the same time, whenever they lose workers, they are not replacing either.
The gloom for February's jobs report is not universal.
We represent the largest health systems in the country, some of the largest tech organizations in the world, attract talent. We're seeing a lot of investment right now.
Adam Stafford at Recruitix says private sector employers are getting ready for an influx of newly unemployed but highly skilled federal workers.
Talent that works in tech, in particular mathematical sciences and economics.
Stafford worries most about federal clerical workers who could be laid off. He says the private sector has already offshored most of those jobs or replaced them with automation. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.